From Cap Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. We are halfway through the year and taking a listen back to some of the most memorable conversations. Since 1962, Taylor's Market in Sacramento's Land Park neighborhood has prided itself on being more than a grocery store, and a crucial piece involves the Johnson family. Danny Johnson was hired as a butcher nearly 40 years ago. In that time, he and his wife Kathy, and eventually their two daughters, made Taylor's Market a bigger part of their family, becoming owners. And they remain steadfast to creating a unique food experience through community. Earlier this year, the market announced the passing of Kathy Johnson. She was 58 years old. But Kathy's family also shared the reason why. From mental health and alcohol addiction. They decided to make her struggle public to help others and to bring to light a disease they say is often stigmatized and misunderstood. I spoke with Kathy's husband, Danny Johnson, about what made her life so remarkable and how he hopes Kathy's story inspires others to seek and successfully get the treatment they need. I want to start off with a trip down memory lane because you've been on Insight before, and we learned at that time that you were hired as a butcher at Taylor's Market back in 1983 at 19 years old. But what we didn't know was that was the same year that you married Kathy and that you two go back even further to childhood. How did you two meet?
We both grew up in the same small town, Penryn, up by Loomis in the foothills. I would stay at my grandmother's, and it was like three houses from where she lived. And her friend would come over and bug me, so I would throw rocks at him to get him away from me. So that was when I was 6 years old and she was five. And we always kind of knew each other, but little did we know that basically 10 years later we would start dating.
And then get married. I can't even imagine when you reflect back on pretty much your entire lives being spent together. Why do you think a childhood of, you know, maybe some nuisances and throwing rocks and stuff led to friendship and really culminated into nearly 40 years of marriage that includes two daughters, Felicia and Lillian?
I don't know. We just always connected. When we got into high school, I was a sophomore when she was a freshman, and I remember her walking the halls, and I told a friend, I'm like, I'm probably going to date her. And he's like, no. And then it was just a couple years later, you know, we were always friends hanging out in the same social group. And it just evolved.
Do you think Kathy would tell the story the same way?
Pretty much, yeah. we were always in lockstep. It was always frustrating for our children because they would come to us for answers, and we could be in separate parts of wherever, and we would give the same answer. Mm. And the girls were always like, you guys are unbelievable.
Well, obviously, Taylor's Market is a big part of your family's life. It's well known in Sacramento. I've been many, many times. But how would you describe it to someone who's never set foot inside?
It's a neighborhood store like there used to be everywhere in this country. It's still a corner grocery store. We're small, but we just pack a lot in there, and we just service. Old-fashioned butcher shop, good produce. We have a bakery. We just like serving people, and we like food.
Lots of yummy stuff in there. You know, it's dangerous when I walk into Taylor's
Yes.
Market. Given that it's such a big piece of your family, what made it the kind of place that you wanted to stay for nearly 40 years?
We were engaged, and I landed there a month before we got married. And I was looking for a job as a butcher.
That must have been a relief.
For her, it was. I was like, oh, it'll work out. And when I walked in, it was like, this is the place I want this type of place I want to work. And I went home and told my dad, I found a place and I'm going to own it one day. And my dad was like, okay, cool it, hotshot. You know, being 19 years old and energetic. And so the opportunity came up 3 or 4 years later to become a partner. And then Kathy and I became sole owners in 2007.
Yep. And it became an even bigger part of your lives. I was reading the bio of one of your daughters, Felicia, who's the operations manager at Taylor's Market. And as she puts it, from sleeping behind the meat counter in a bassinet as an infant to working in the offices as an adult, what has been the most, on the one hand, rewarding, but also the challenging aspects of operating a business that is so deeply ingrained with your family?
The most rewarding is working with your family. The biggest challenge is working with your family.
That's a perfect way to put it.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's like a period too. You don't even need a comment.
Yeah, it's you have to have a time to disconnect and go, okay, we're not going to talk about the store. But most of our travels and stuff always revolved around either chasing genealogy or looking at food. I've drugged Kathy into butcher shops all around the world.
What are some of the favorite places that the two of you have traveled? Because travel is really, you both were bitten by the travel bug.
Yeah. Australia, New Zealand. We absolutely fell in love with Singapore and in anywhere in Europe.
Given that Kathy passed away in February, you know, we're talking to you because of the message that you and your family wrote on the Taylor's Market Facebook page. It was just so beautifully written. It was so moving. You could really visualize and feel who Kathy was, what got her up in the morning, what sparked her passions and her creativity. But you as a family also made the choice to be honest about why she passed away in a way that doesn't really get typically shared in public, which you also acknowledge in that message. What kind of conversations did you have as a family to make that decision to share Kathy's struggle with mental health and alcohol addiction?
Her and I had talked about this, and I had told her that she had the platform and the power to help people if she could get sober. And when she was sober, she was like, yeah, I think that's a great idea. When she was drinking, of course, she didn't want to let anybody know. There's a lot of stigma and shame attached to this disease. So I told her, I said, look, if this doesn't work out, because last year she told me, she goes, I think my bottom, every alcoholic talks about a bottom. And she goes, I believe my bottom very well could be death. And I was like, look, I don't want to hear that. And she's like, you can keep throwing money at this disease. We can keep doing rehabs. And she goes, I can't, I just don't think I can overcome it. It's way bigger than anything I've ever experienced. So I told her, I said, I will tell your story and you're going to have an impact. And you don't think you have an impact right now, but you do, and you will. And so as a family, we've always been honest and open. We always taught the girls to be open with us. Sometimes there's stuff that I don't want to hear them tell me, but that's all right. I'd rather them tell me. And so when we were writing, we wrote the obituary, and then at the very end of it, we added in that. And my cousin did most of the writing. And she read it out loud to me, and I sat there and I went, I can't do this. But again, I was, it was 3 or 4 days after Kathy's passing, and I was just like, I don't know if I can do this. And then I thought about it for about 30 seconds, looked at my youngest Lillian, and Luna looked at Felicia, and they both said, yeah, we can do it. And I'm like, okay, full speed ahead. And it's been a little empowering. It's also the outpouring from the community. People are like, wow. And it's we got to get rid of the stigma somehow. So if this just helps one person, then I consider it a success.
And I hope that we help with that, too, by you being here and taking the time. What I particularly love about the post that was written is that it's really a love letter to Kathy. I mean, yes, you include why she passed away, but you make sure that people know the enormous beauty that she had in her life and that she also knew that it was extraordinary. Is that complete picture often missing from the conversation when we're talking about mental health and addiction?
Yeah, a little bit, because people tend to define someone by maybe mental health or addiction. And we wanted to make sure that she wasn't defined by that. That just happened to be her cause of death. I was very fortunate. Kathy and I were very fortunate. We lived a fairy tale for 38 years. The last five, to be completely frank, it wasn't a fairy tale. It was a nightmare. But the previous years, we were together for 43 years, and 38 years were absolutely wonderful. And then when she really started going down the rabbit hole and losing her way, when there was times of clarity with her, I just cherished that because I'm like, okay, I got to make the most of what I have. And we would have these open and honest conversations. And we were always open with each other. And I said, this is killing you. I'm watching you die in front of me. And she would say, you're right. And she goes, I don't know why you stick around. And I'm like, because I take my wedding vows seriously and I'm not going to abandon you. So I told her, I said, I'm in it for how long it takes, whatever happens, I'm with you.
You mentioned the outpouring of support that you received from that post, because both of these conditions exist in countless families. But for those who don't live with this directly in their life, what do you hope they better understand?
That there is hope, that there are programs out there that are doing some really good work now that you can get the addict into. And then as on the other side of it, on my side of it, as I guess the caretaker, if you will,
there's
also programs that help. I became a member of Al-Anon 6 years ago, and it helped me keep my sanity. The biggest issue I had with Al-Anon was the anonymity part, because I think that's an old way of thinking. And I've been very vocal about that when I go to meetings. And I said, look, I don't believe in the anonymous part. I understand it. I understand why people would want to be anonymous. But I think in today's society, if we're going to help and truly help cure addiction issues, then we need to be out in the open.
If there's a loved one who's listening to this and they have someone that they deeply care about who is battling mental health and addiction, but perhaps at this time in their life, they're overcome with frustration and just overwhelming helplessness, what would you like them to take away and know?
Just know that first you got to take care of yourself. And with addiction, it's not about you, it's about them. But you kind of want to take it on yourself and go, I can fix this. And you can't. You know, you didn't cause it, you can't cure it, and you can't control it. So those are the three C's that I learned in Al-Anon. But there is help out there for both sides of this, for the addict and the family. I have yet to talk to anyone who doesn't know someone through, you know, the so-called 6 degrees of separation, who does not know someone that's in their world that has an issue like this.
Yeah, myself included. Yeah, I completely agree with you. How are you and your daughters doing?
We're doing pretty good. I mean, we have good days and bad days. All in all, the reality is, and I get asked that a lot, is personally, I've been grieving for 3 years because the last three have been pretty brutal. So there was a lot of time when I was by myself, even though she was present, but she wasn't present. Physically, she was present, but she wasn't mentally. So I've kind of been preparing myself, going, and I would tell the girls, I started 3 years ago telling them, I go, I'm going to come in and find your mom one day. This is, you know, it was just a game of chance, and her body just couldn't handle it anymore. Her body just gave out. So all in all, not too bad. Yeah, I do I miss alcoholic Kathy? No, I don't. Do I miss the love of my life? Yes, I do.
Grief is such a individual trying journey. It can be obviously comforting when shared with others, but there are always moments, sometimes more than we would like, when we're faced with it alone. Given that Kathy was a love of your life, you two have shared the majority of your lives together, have you begun to kind of take in and reflect on all that you shared and also succeeded in as a pair?
Yeah, I mean, I walk in my house and everything has her touch on it. Everything that we have has a story. When we got married, we didn't have anything. I said this when I did her eulogy, that we, at our wedding, we had a money dance because we were just trying to raise funds because we were so broke. And it actually was wildly successful. But everything in our home has a story. And I was telling the girls, I said, we're going to have to go around and video everything so I can, they know some of the stories, but some of them they don't know. You know, whether it's books or art or rugs or just anything. Pretty much everything has been a collection of our lives.
How wonderful. I mean, the both of you are from the foothills, from the Loomis area in Placer County, but it's not too far of a drive to Sacramento, where you've spent a great deal of your lives. What did Kathy love most about Sacramento?
it's funny because she started down here before I did, and she wanted to buy an old Victorian downtown. And I'm like, no, that's a horrible idea. This is 1983. And I said, first of all, we don't have any money. Second of all, I don't want to live in downtown Sacramento. Well, here we are, and we have a Victorian in downtown Sacramento. We've been down here for 18 years. She just liked the fact that we could walk everywhere and go to a different restaurant or walk to the Crocker Art Museum. Downtown's so walkable. And we would go on these long walks. And when you're walking downtown, you see things that you don't see in a car. And I still go on walks every day, and I always see something different.
Yeah, I completely agree with you. You touched upon this, but you mentioned, you know, Kathy was really a pillar in the community, very active in the community, supportive of philanthropic efforts, also social issues as well. But I feel as though this post and the public conversations that you've been having since then have really expanded Kathy's reach to touch even more lives. Do you feel that way as well?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. We had kind of had the conversation back in the fall that she has a relative who is a contemporary of Rembrandt, and we traced him back to the Rijksmuseum, and we have obtained some of his art. And
wow.
I said, you know, and she kept talking about, she goes, I just don't know if I can beat this thing. And I go, well, if you don't beat this and you pass on from this, you very well could end up more famous in your passing than when you were alive because of the message that we're going to put out. And she knew what the message was going to be. And she's like, so I might be like a famous artist and be better off. And I'm like, well, you could be. I said, we don't want that, but you very well could be. So that's kind of the analogy I use. It's kind of a weird analogy, but.
Where does that come from? Wanting to share, you know, sometimes the darkest parts of our lives to help others.
I just would not want anybody else to go through this. I wouldn't wish addiction issues on any person. And I would seriously wouldn't wish it on family members to have to watch it. Both sides of it are horrible. I had someone recently say, man, you really got it bad. And I go, no. I said, I'm still here. Kathy had it bad.
You held an event at Mulvaney's, I believe, a bon voyage for Kathy.
Correct.
What were some of the moments that still stay with you?
Oh, just the people that showed up, former employees that I was just blown away, people making the drive, friends. I had a friend that didn't even realize they were friends of ours, but we didn't realize that they even knew about it. Because in that moment, you forget, you're trying to contact everybody or get the message out, and this couple walked in and they had driven up from Santa Barbara in the storm. It was a stormy day. And I was just completely blown away. Some of the former chefs that we had in the restaurant, you know, one of them drove up from Fresno. And I just looked at him and I was like, man, thank you very much. And he's like, of course. He goes, you guys gave me a foundation. So just, you know, being touched by how Kathy's touched people. It was, the outpouring was great.
And even now, you're discussing starting a nonprofit as well in her memory called Don't Turn Your Back on Addiction.
We were going to start a nonprofit. We still want to name something, Don't Turn Your Back on Addiction. But I found out through one of Kathy's friends who has been wonderful. She has a love for fashion just like Kathy, and they bonded, and she's also in recovery. She got involved in a program over at UC Davis called the Substance Use Navigator Program that they have at their med center. It's in their emergency room, and they want to put this in every emergency room in California. And it's groundbreaking, and it saved her life. And I tried to get Kathy into that and wasn't successful. But they already have everything in place. They have the infrastructure in place. They have the donation website in place. So we're moving all of our efforts into that. But I still like the name Don't Turn Your Back on Addiction, simply because I came up with that name when I was explaining to a customer what happened. And the lady, she looked at me and she goes, at first we said, you know, it was a long-term illness. And that was in the initial stages. And then she kind of pressed me. She goes, did she have cancer? I said, no, she died from alcoholism. And she literally turned her back. She did not know what to say. It was a shock to her. And right there was my aha moment. I went, okay, we need to put a name on this. So that's where that name came from.
Given that Taylor's Market has been a staple in Sacramento for over 60 years, and you and Kathy have been a part of it for close to 40 years. I mean, you just talked to a customer and opened up about Kathy's passing. I think it just, that's a testament to how you shape and touch lives in the community. In what ways did Kathy leave her mark on Taylor's Market?
Same thing as in my home. Everywhere you look, there's something.
Everywhere.
There's just something that, you know, it's like, okay, we got to set things up a certain way. Even though she was never involved in the meat counter, some of the ways I do things, she's in my head going, no, it's got to be this way. The attention to detail. So she was very detail-oriented. So she wouldn't miss any kind of detail. So it's just the details, just the flowers, just the decorations.
Finally, you know, going back to that customer that you talked to and that really inspired the name that you want to carry in Kathy's honor, Don't Turn Your Back on Addiction, what do you hope Kathy's legacy will be?
Well, I think to be remembered for the worldly woman that she was, from, you know, the woman who grew up in a small town but knew that there was a lot bigger world out there and wanted to explore that world, her sense of fashion, her sense of style, and unfortunately, the cause of death, she can make change with that. You know, people can remember, hey, if it can happen to someone that essentially had everything, it can happen to anyone. You know, she had all the resources. She had everything to fight this. You know, financially, she wasn't without health insurance. There are so many people that don't have health insurance. That's where the UC Davis program helps out. So just a small town girl who became wildly successful, but then succumbed to a insidious disease.
I think that highlights that there's so much that's missing from the conversation collectively.
Absolutely. Yes. Yeah, people think, and that's the thing, people look at something, especially in the world of social media, and they're like, that's the perfect life. But you start peeling away layers of that onion, and most of the time it's not. And I'm proof of that. People all the time said, man, you guys got it made. And yeah, to a certain extent, we do. But now it's not a we, it's a me. And I would love to go back to the we, but you know, now it's time to turn that page.
Well, Danny, thank you so much for being open and vulnerable, because it really allows us to go past assumptions and to better understand something that touches so many lives.
Yes, it does. And hopefully we can affect some people that they go, hey, man, you know, maybe we can speak out or we can get our loved one some help.
Danny Johnson is the owner and head butcher at Taylor's Market, sharing his wife Kathy's battle with mental health and alcohol addiction to raise awareness and help others. Kathy passed away in February. If you or someone you know is suffering from a mental illness or struggling with addiction, call 988, which is the Suicide and Crisis Lifeline. There's also the National Alliance on Mental Health. You can text HELPLINE to 6264. Up next, the deadly 2018 Montecito mudslides killed 23 people in Santa Barbara County. A survivor who lost her husband, son, and family dog in the disaster joins us about writing her debut memoir, Where the Yellow Flowers Bloom, a true story of hope through unimaginable loss. You're listening to a special Best Of edition of Insight on your NPR station, CAP Radio. I'm Vicki Gonzalez. We're back in just a moment.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.
You're listening to a special edition of Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. In the early morning hours of January 8th, 2018, as people were sleeping, mudslides in Santa Barbara County rushed into the town of Montecito. 23 people were killed. The force of boulders, coupled with rushing mud 15 feet deep, traveling at 30 miles per hour, destroyed more than 100 homes. Kim Canton and her family awoke to a downpour of rain, rushing to evacuate, but it was too late. Both she and her daughter Lauren were gravely injured, but were rescued from the debris more than 100 yards from where their home once stood, and they survived. However, her husband Dave, her son Jack, and their dog Chester perished. Her husband's remains were found more than a mile from their home, and it would take more than 3 years to find some of her son's remains. Kim wrote a memoir to help others find healing through tremendous grief, titled Where Yellow Flowers Bloom, A True Story of Hope Through Unimaginable Loss. Well, first, I want to start off with your husband, Dave, and your son, Jack. What would you like us to know about them and your family?
Thank you. They were some of the good guys. My husband had a kind heart. He worked from his youth all the way up and a self-made man, and then became a scoutmaster, a Boy Scout Boy Scout leader in the Montecito troops, so he could spend more time with his son. And that became a very meaningful part of his life. You know, he's very family focused. And my son, I would say was an old soul, and he passed away at 17, but I'd say he fit in his 17 years more than some people do in their 80 years. His soul could connect to other people pretty easily. He did a lot of volunteer work, established some volunteer groups in town, and was really, you know, loved by his friends and family.
When did you decide to write a book?
During COVID, when everything was quiet, we were all in our houses, there's not much to do. And I said, you know, I was worried I might forget some of the details. So I said, why don't I write it down? So when I have grandkids, I have some of the facts down. And then as I started to write it, the people who were helping in the search team, you know, some pretty stunning things occurred during that. And they said, you have to write this down. So it was kind of a combination of the COVID plus some prompting from people close to me is how that all happened.
You know, that horrifying morning and just the aftermath of tremendous loss is very much present in your memoir. But there are also so many special and I felt these beautifully eerie moments that are also uplifting. Did you know from the beginning that was how you were going to pursue writing this book?
No, it just, I never thought I'd ever write a book. I never thought I'd have anything to write about. And it just sort of evolved. And, you know, I'd put it down for a month or two and then go back to it. And I had a few people read it and say, I want to know a little bit more about this. Like, I didn't write as much about my family or Dave and Jack, kind of the personal anecdotes. And they said, we want to know who these people were. Like, they, you know, my friends knew who they were, but they said, you know, tell a little more about that.
Prior to reading the book, it was very difficult for me to visualize what you all went through, how a mudslide could be so deadly, leaving just such little impossible room to escape. Your family had already evacuated multiple times the month prior due to the Thomas fire, and the days leading up to the mudslide, you were preparing with sandbags, you were aware that there was a risk, you and your husband were worried. But was there a way to adequately prepare for what was going to happen?
I think we did the best we could, and we had, because of the Thomas fire, they have these aware and beware notifications that are on your phone that would blast like an Amber Alert. So we had those, we had the news. So we relied on that information to guide our decision making. And what I would say to others is don't. If you sense any threat that's in your general area, get out, right? They miscalculated, and it was it was a perfect story. There's so much rain that came down, you know, and then you had the mountain that didn't have foliage on it.
Yeah, and you, I mean, this book, I think a lot of people can resonate with the aftermath. You know, given that, you know, your family was awakened by this heavy downpour at 3 o'clock in the morning. I mean, so many people were sleeping.
Mm-hmm. You know, often people can use hindsight in a torturous way, like if only we had done things differently. How did you come to find peace or closure with what happened, you know, in the spirit of helping someone else who may be dwelling on how things could have been different?
That's a great question. Actually, I think it was Dave's funeral. The priest, his sermon was on don't do the woulda, coulda, shouldas. And I come with strong faith, and I know we all did the best we could in the moment with the information we had. My daughter did the best she could, you know, because she had a feeling something bad was going to happen, and she tried to tell us. And we did the best we could because we were following the news and watching our Aware and Beware, and we put the sandbags down. So I think for me is, and I've learned in grief, be gentle on yourself, right? I don't think there's many coincidences in life, and maybe it was their time. Maybe, you know, they graduated, they're in pure joy. They did what they were supposed to do on earth and evolved the way they should. And maybe they graduated, but the priest helped me with the don't do the coulda, woulda, shouldas.
Yeah. I mean, you bring up intuition, and that is such a powerful thread throughout your memoir. I mean, this overarching mm-hmm. lesson of listening to your gut or your intuition, but not only yours, mm-hmm. but listening to others as well when they share things mm-hmm. with you. What did that teach you? Because, I mean, you wrote, and I believe in part you said, like, I was listening to other people's intuition that I may have overlooked in the past.
Yeah. This really filleted me open, right? And I knew because I lost everything. You know, I didn't even have ID with me. I didn't have a passport. I didn't have a birth certificate, nothing. I had to rely on other people. And I knew because I was a high doer. I normally took care of everything. I knew in this situation, I was put in a situation I couldn't. And so I had to trust the process. I just kind of learned to trust the process. And part of it was because I was stripped so vulnerable and bare, and I couldn't put up the barriers to say, I'm going to take care of it all myself, because it wasn't possible. I was so injured. I was, had nothing. My girlfriends gave me clothes out of their closet. You know, it was, then you just kind of learn, trust the process. And the sister at the church, she kept saying, and at first it got me mad. She goes, all in God's time, and God's time's the right time. And I'm like, yeah, I don't really buy that. And then, you know, the search went on. It was 3 years, and I think she was absolutely right. So she was telling me in that message, trust the process. Just trust.
Yeah. I mean, it's incredible that you were able to find, you know, part of your son's remains Memorial Day of 2021. Mm. So that was more than mm-hmm. 3 years of just dedicated, tenacious mm-hmm. rescue efforts from you, from loved ones. But you also brought mm-hmm. in anthropologists as well. Mm-hmm. How mm-hmm. formative were those, or fundamental were those anthropologists in helping give you some closure?
They're terrific. And we tried to do everything. You know, we brought in ground penetrating radar. We had historical search dogs. We had search and rescue dogs, because they're different. We tried to do all the logical stuff, how we cleared things and observed. But then I talked to a friend of mine who is a detective, and I told him what we had done. And he says, I think you need a forensic anthropologist. And I had never heard that term before. I said, well, where do I find one of those? And he says, at a local university, they'll have one. So I wrote a university and explained who I was and say, this is what the detective said, because it had been a while now. And at first we were looking for, you know, an intact large male. And we came to realize we may not get intact. And so she responded right away. And no one thing made the difference. However, it was if we were going to find our needle in the haystack, we needed them. And they actually found some needle in the haystack by their meticulous techniques and their science and all that they had. But it was really, it was kind of a culmination of so many things. All the different elements helped get us toward what we ended up, you know, finding.
You had, you know, so many of these almost like full circle moments, because you had mm-hmm. reminders of your son over the years. You would find them as you were trying to search for him. Mm-hmm. But mm-hmm. what I think about is the significance that, and also this is going off of your intuition, you took family photos just a couple months before all of this happened, that including your family dog, Chester. How did mm-hmm. that location come into play years later after finding your son's remains?
Yeah, I tell that story and others in the book, but that was fascinating because it was just really maybe a month before the tragedy. I just had this overwhelming sense, I need to get family pictures. I just have to get them. And then I got them done and I said, and I needed ones of the dog. And it was right before Christmas. I didn't want to spend the extra money, but I just had this really strong pull. And my friend took us to this area that was beautiful, this open space with coastal oaks and a beautiful creek. And it was just pretty and staged lovely boulders at the time when I thought boulders were lovely. And we sat there. And what was pretty mind-blowing is after when we were looking for Jack, I wanted to get like clues and stuff. And I asked the photographer, would you walk me where we took the pictures? And unbelievably, it's where we had been getting the clues and where we'd been searching, but it looked different now, but that's the exact same place. So it was just, you just kind of shake your head and going, what coincidence.
Yeah. Why the title, Where the Yellow Flowers Bloom?
It's a metaphor, right? And I give my daughter credit for that. The pile, the debris pile where Jack's remains were found on, the soil was like a toxic soup. It had arsenic. It had broken sewage stuff. It was just a mess. It was people's garage paints. And you would think nothing could grow there. And when we got there, it was graced with beautiful yellow flowers. So it's really a metaphor to look for the beauty when you think there might be none. Because what the student said to me, she clipped some of the flowers and she brought them to me in a vase and she said, life found a way. And I said, no, love found a way.
That is just beautiful and so powerful. You, this book, this memoir really is very much about finding healing to give to others, to pay it forward, given the support that you received under something unimaginable and that invaluable support shown by others. But I think it's also important to understand the toll of trauma that you and your daughter, who was just 14 years old at the time, endured. I mean, you lead mm-hmm. the book with that. I mean, it's a letter of recommendation for college that was written by one of Lauren's firefighter rescuers. She was entombed, essentially, under debris. Her body was contorted for hours with little space for air. You know, how was it to read that as her mother? I know you probably had conversations about what you both went through, but to get that perspective from a rescuer to just see what she went through as a young girl.
Oh, it breaks your heart because as a parent, right, every parent wants to protect their child. And you feel like you went there to protect her, to help her. She was totally alone. And it breaks your heart to feel everything that she had to endure. And it was kind of awe-inspiring to get the sense of how strong she really was, and her character, her resolve. She's the strongest person I know.
I think also the fact that this was a letter of recommendation for college, it kind of encapsulates that although life goes on and love finds a way, we're also shaped by our past.
Mm-hmm. Sure we are. And in the hospital, I remember when all this was going down, one of the first things I said to Lauren, I said, this will not define us. I do not want this event to define us. It will have an impact. But this is, we are other people. We are people who like to go camping. We are like to go swimming. She's going to go off and have a great career after college. She's going to get married, maybe, and have kids. This is one element, not the element in our life.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. And if you're just joining us, I'm talking with Kim Canton, a survivor of the deadly Montecito mudslides in 2018, about her debut book, Where the Yellow Flowers Bloom. It's a memoir to help others find hope through unimaginable loss after losing her husband, son, and family dog to the disaster. Both she and her daughter, Lauren, survived. How is Lauren doing today?
She's doing well. She's doing well. She's just one amazing gal. She did ran an event relative to the book launch with some friends and the firefighters and, you know, the people who had really helped. And she surprised me singing a Joni Mitchell song, which was it just brought everyone to tears because it was so moving, you know, it was talking. What is it about the clouds? the Joni Mitchell songs about clouds. It was just wonderful. Everyone knows the song.
You mentioned songs. I mean, you have song titles for each part of the book. Were those songs cathartic for you over the years, or did they come to you as you were writing?
They just came to me. I'm like, what would be a good one for this? And actually, on Jack's memorial video, they put the Jack Johnson's Better Together song to it. And I said, you know what? I'm talking about what my family was like before the mudslide, so Better Together is a good title. So it just kind of, it just kind of came to me.
I also love that a lot of your book, there are these personal recollections. It's almost like a diary, you know, these seemingly mundane everyday moments that we can all just very easily take for granted. But with the hindsight that you have of loss and grief, you know, I think any of us would give anything to get those moments back. Did that teach you to be more present in life today?
Absolutely. I think I am. I think that's one of the silver linings is I try just to be present in the moment. And what someone told me once, what makes people maybe unhappy is if they get attached to a specific outcome. Like, I really want that car. If I don't get that car, life's not going to be good, right? And so you get all tied up wanting this one car and that car doesn't happen or whatever it is. I was, you know, what I've learned is if you're just present and don't get tied to a specific outcome of I need this or I need that, kind of live a more peaceful life, I think.
Mm-hmm. You also mentioned that you're a person of faith, but you write in the book that, you know, you're just very welcoming of other cultures and traditions and ways of healing.
Sure.
You had a Native American ceremony for Jack. Mm-hmm. You use, I believe it would be considered a medium to help find your son's remains. And one of Jack's favorite quotes that he put into a time capsule at school was a Buddhist scripture. Where did all of this come from? Because it encompasses your family, not just you.
I'm just open to it all, right? I just you know, I'm Christian and, you know, our family, you know, went to church and, you know, I grew up in the Christian faith and, you know, was a Sunday school teacher, but I'm, you know, it's a big, big world and a lot of people and however they want to view a higher power or how to live life, I'm absolutely open and acknowledgement. Yeah, I think it's terrific.
In the years since, when it comes to grief, it can be shared with loved ones, but it's also very personal and individual. What advice do you have for someone who perhaps is a caregiver or a parent, a guardian, helping, you know, themselves let grief move through them, but also someone who's younger, like your daughter, Lauren? How did you guys experience grief together, but also separately?
That's a great question. What you have to realize is everyone's grief journey is different, right? My daughter was 14. I was in my early 50s. Her 14-year-old brain could only handle what a 14-year-old brain could want to process, and her unique trauma was different from mine. So that impacted it. So everyone's grief journey is individual and acknowledging that. And I think of grief as a big bowl of messy spaghetti. It's messy and you don't know what you're going to get, and it hits you sometimes as a wave. And I would just say, hold on. I have a dear friend of mine who lost his wife in fall. And I remember saying to him, you know, when I saw him one day, he looked kind of sad. And I just said, it's going to get better. Right? I was a few years out from him in my grief journey. But hold on. There's a song by Wilson Phillips, China Phillips. And it's hold on for one more day. Just hold on. It's going to get lighter.
Given that this winter season, I mean, atmospheric rivers once again prompted evacuations in the area. I was reading an LA Times article and the headline was, you know, 5 years to the day after deadly mudslides, rains again force families from their Montecito homes. How do you navigate that, you know, every year, you know, potentially having just the memory at least of what happened?
Well, I have trauma related to that. I can tell, like, when I'm in town and when that happened, the Wear and Beware blasts were going off. They were doing evacuations. And I was more hypervigilant. You know, I didn't want to, if it was raining, I told my daughter and I, we are not driving on the streets. Whereas normally people might drive on the street to go to the grocery store. And I was just, no, we're not going on the street. This is, and then I was really vigilant. So I'm working with my EMDR trauma therapist to see if they can help lessen that. I know I was in two different areas when there was heavy rain this past 3 months, and one was a place that I grew up, and it was raining there, and it didn't bother me at all because that place never let me down before, right? this place has let me down. Then I was on the Northeast doing a visiting someone and it rained in. Didn't bother me there. So what I'm learning in my trauma is that it is specific to this area because the mountain did come down. And it's a risk here. And so I'll have to navigate that and see what that, you know, what the implications are for me with that.
Finally, Kim, what do you hope readers take away from your book?
Yeah, you know, I really hope my biggest goal is this book lands in the hands of someone who can find some hope in it, right? Like, I'm the poster child of bad things that happen. You know, house washes away, husband dies, 17-year-old son dies, dog dies, like, daughter's buried alive. It's all check the box of bad, bad, and bad. I hope they can see through my journey of the desperate grief to more peaceful adaptation, that they too can get through it. And maybe some of the things I learned might help them. That's all. That's the whole purpose of the book.
Kim, thank you so much for making the time.
Thank you. Take care now.
Kim Canton is a survivor of the deadly Montecito mudslides in 2018, sharing her debut book, Where Yellow Flowers Bloom, a memoir to help others find hope through tremendous loss after losing her husband, son, and family dog to the disaster. Both Kim and her daughter Lauren survived. You're listening to a special best of edition of Insight here on CAP Radio. We're celebrating the halfway mark of 2023, spending the hour listening back to some of the best conversations we've had so far this year. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. We're back in just a moment.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.
Welcome back to Insight on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. We're closing a special show, taking a listen back to some of the best conversations so far this year. In the past 6 months, we've clocked a couple hundred interviews so far in 2023. And thank you for taking the time to listen in and be part of them. And with that, that's it for Insight today. You can learn more about our guests at capradio.org/insight. You can also subscribe to the Insight podcast on Apple, Spotify, or the Google Play Store. If you want to join the conversation, it's simple. Shoot us an email at insight@capradio.org. Thank you to producers Nick Dobis and Victor Corral Martinez, with managing editor Arm Sarkissian. Our digital producer is Megan Minata. Insight's technical director is Mark Jones, and our engineers are Antonio Munez and Chris Feltz. Our show music is produced by Adrian Gilmore. And I'm Vicky Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us. You'll hear from us soon.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.